welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope you had a wonderful North Dakota weekend. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, Sean Abbas gives us an update on the VA healthcare system and talks about the opening of two new community-based outpatient clinics, one in Dickinson and one in Williston. And we also visit The Tell, which is a live monthly storytelling event in downtown Fargo, where audience volunteers are randomly selected to share a six-minute unscripted story. And we have the winning story from the November 2024 event. And we begin Main Street today with my guest, Senator Tim Mathern. He hails from Fargo. Senator, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you. I enjoy visiting with you.
There are two bills that we would like to discuss today. First is Senate Bill 2446. It's an act that would provide an appropriation to the Legislative Council for the purpose of contracting with a consultant to study the feasibility and desirability of creating a regenerative grazing ranch in the state, otherwise maybe known as Grand Ranch. And then we also would like to get into Senator Mathern's proposal to appropriate $100 million for regional acute psychiatric services, and that's Senate Bill 2096, for those who are following along at home. But first, Senator, your bill relative to Grand Ranch, we'll call it today, you emphasized the need to study the issue before investing in it. What gaps in knowledge do you perceive that is there that you hope this study can address? And then how will these findings be used to inform future policy or funding decisions?
Well, we have an issue in our state regarding carbon dioxide, which is now considered a pollutant, and it's creating all kinds of climate change issues. And then we have a belated debate about capturing this and pumping it underground in North Dakota from places around the Midwest. Well, we also have a concern about grasslands and people plowing up grasslands and putting it into corn. Well, I'm trying to bring these issues together and to study the possibility that we can monetize, essentially give money to ranchers to have grazing practices that do two things. One is take up this carbon dioxide in the air, where we have too much of, and change it into a soil ingredient of carbon, which regenerates our soil, and then pay the rancher for grazing practices that maximize the possibilities. So a Grand Ranch is basically a place where we research these issues and give information to ranchers on how to best graze and monetize their land.
You referenced Grand Sky and Grand Farm as examples of major state investments in your testimony last Thursday without pre-legislative planning. So how does this bill ensure that a similar investment in regenerative grazing is based through then research and data?
Well, you know, Grand Sky and Grand Farm sort of snuck up on us. We had very strong proponents to get some $30 million in the Grand Sky, $10 million thus far in Grand Farm. And we really didn't study in advance what the money would be used for, who would own it, who are the other partners. And this is saying, okay, we have another issue here. Let's do it differently. Let's study it first. For example, what should be the role of North Dakota State University? What should be the role of our present grasslands research? What should be the role of our federal agencies that are involved in subsidizing grazing and grazing practices? So the concept here is, yes, specializing in special activities of our state makes sense, but let's, in advance, study the various variables so we can decide, should this be a special place where we spend millions and millions of dollars, or should it be a place that just is an extension of a present activity in our state? You know, we have to be prudent with our dollars. We have a lot of income in our state, but it may not last forever. So let's make sure that we're prudent, knowledgeable, and that's what this study would do, is say, let's look at all the variables and then decide what kind of investment to make.
We're enjoying our conversation with Senator Tim Mathern. He hails from Fargo, and he's served in the North Dakota legislature since 1987. The study you talk about sets aside a relatively modest amount, $49,500. What factors went into determining that figure, and how does it ensure that a meaningful outcome will be, I guess, gained without excessive spending?
Well, some of these studies, we've spent millions of dollars. And I just wanted to clarify in advance that just like we're going to be prudent in the whole Grand Ranch idea, we're going to be prudent in the study idea. We have people already studying this. So let's take those North Dakota citizens into our embrace, involve them. For example, person who testified at the hearing the other day was Dr. Rebecca Phillips. She's actually a world-renowned scientist who's published 50 articles or more, scientific journal articles on this concept. And she could be a consultant, for example. There could be people from the universities. And so it's really being prudent in the amount, using our local citizens. And then it also is, it's under the amount that requires another process of going to the Appropriations Committee. We have a limit of $50,000. And so this is a really prudent idea for our legislative process. Instead of going through more and more committees, actually just going through the agricultural committees, having a full vote in the full Senate and the House is possible by this amount of dollars. But the main point is, let's be prudent, let's be conservative, let's use our own people to get the information out.
You mentioned Dr. Phillips' research. She, along with Dr. Shelley Lentz, a veterinarian from the Dickinson area, did testify. Dr. Phillips' research suggests that managed grazing can significantly increase carbon capture and improve ecosystem reliance. Do you envision then that North Dakota should become a national leader in carbon smart ranching? Is this part of your concept, Senator Mathern?
Yes. I think what we have here is the potential to bring these variables together, the carbon pollutants, people living off the land, the environmental concerns. We have all of those things right here in North Dakota. And the information that we could put together under this concept of Grand Ranch is going to be important for the entire Midwest. And I think that's what's happening with Grand Sky, with Grand Farm. And this is just taking it to another part of our ecology. And I think as time goes on, people in the Midwest will look to North Dakota for the outcomes of this kind of research. Somebody has to focus, and we could be the first state to do that focus. And I have no doubt many people will look to the outcome of this research to guide their laws and their policies in their states.
Some legislators express skepticism about carbon-related initiatives. This bill addresses those concerns and tries to frame carbon research as a benefit, it seems to me, to ranching and the state's economy. Do you envision the economic benefits that are just greater than, I guess, managing or conserving land in a positive way?
You know, that's one of the concerns I wanted to address in introducing this bill. We have pro-oil folks, pro-environmental folks. We have conflict between those two groups. And I was looking for a way that we can move out of conflict and just move into a function, a process, an activity that really addresses both of those variables. Yeah, we can fight forever on having more power plants or less, more concerns for the environment or less, but this is just being pragmatic. It's just saying, come on, let's address what we have before us. Let's work on a positive way of addressing these conflicts in our culture, and let's not spend all our time on the conflicts.
Senator, this study produces strong evidence then supporting regenerative grazing as a viable carbon sequestration strategy. What would the next steps be, and how would you anticipate then a request for additional funding or a path to move forward towards policy initiatives then for ranchers?
Well, I would say, number one, educating our ranchers in terms of this possibility for them. Also providing infrastructure dollars for ranching in a new way, fences and wells and water. I think that would be important. And then a greater measurement system. Who knows? Is it possible that we could take enough of this carbon from the air and not need these controversial carbon pipelines? I mean, that's a big controversy. Do we bring in this waste gas from other states, bury it in North Dakota? That's a big conflict. Well, wouldn't it be wonderful if we figured out a way we can do this with our natural system? So I think that's another outcome is, can we apply these principles to avoid other conflicts in our society?
Senator Mathern, let's grab a different bill out of the stack of bills in front of you that you're considering for the legislature. You sponsored also Senate Bill 2096 that would appropriate $100 million for regional acute psychiatric services. It's a move that would change the way our state hospital in Jamestown functions and would also then challenge how that state hospital is invested in the future. First, what prompted you to introduce the bill, and how does it address gaps in your mind in North Dakota's mental health care system?
Okay, Craig, I am a professional social worker. I've worked in behavioral health for 53 years. I have a master's degree in social work, probably one of the first licenses in North Dakota back in 1980. So I know the life of persons who have mental health illness. I know the life of families who have a member who has mental illness. I know the system of care or lack of care. And the research says that when you put somebody into treatment, centralized treatment like at a state hospital from all over the state, you destroy their relationships of support. The family members can't visit. The employing entity can't keep track of the person. The local services like group care, AA, supportive housing, those things are not connected. So the person leaving a centralized facility may have gotten well for 10 days or 15 days or 20, but they can't maintain it because those other connections are either lost or not instigated. So we have an initiative before us to build a $300 million new state hospital. That is old medicine. It does not work. And so my initiative is to say, well, let's give some grants out around the state for facilities to upgrade and change so that they take care of these patients. For example, St. Alexis in Bismarck, they could have 30, 40 beds for persons of mental illness. They could have step-down services, residential for people that need supervised living. They could have an outpatient clinic. Well, that then creates a situation for the people in the Southwest can go to Bismarck instead of going all the way to Jamestown. We can do the same in Minot. We can do the same in Grand Forks. We can do the same in Fargo and then other smaller communities. However, the main point is, let's not waste $300 million. Let's use money to support regional care so that people, once identified as having a mental illness or a substance use disorder, get treatment in the context of their ability to stay well in the years going forward.
What challenges have you encountered, Senator, relative to getting bipartisan support for this bill, and how are you addressing those concerns from either lawmakers or stakeholders? I would assume that you're hearing a lot from the folks in the Jamestown area that perhaps have a different view of mental health services than you do.
Oh, it's interesting. There are two feedbacks I get from Jamestown community. One is, we need these jobs here, so please build it here. But I also get the feedback that many persons who are discharged from the hospital stay in Jamestown. And I haven't checked the facts, but somebody told me that they have a disproportionate number of persons who have had mental illness, sexual-related problems that are living now in Jamestown. So that it kind of goes both ways for the Jamestown folks. But the pushback is essentially, we've done it like this for so many years. It's difficult to change. And the other thing is, we've done some investment of the design of a new hospital. We spent $12 million. So some people are saying, well, we spent that money for the design. We should follow through. That to me is really short-term thinking. In fact, the design itself, I think, is incorrect. The design is incorrect for modern-day mental health care. The design is kind of based on this model of hundreds of years ago. The model is based on you take people with mental illness, you put them in the country, you give them a lot of sunlight, you give them a lot of space, you give them a lot of opportunities to kind of take it easy, and then they will get well. Well, that's old medicine. We know now that a mental illness is really something broke in the brain, or some missing chemical in the brain, or some trauma that requires a kind of a therapeutic counseling process. This is different than, you know, sit in the sun and you'll get well. And so that's another issue. It's there's kind of a reliance on old thinking, and there's kind of a reliance on, we've always done it this way. And there's kind of a reliance on, well, it's in our constitution that we should have a state hospital. Well, all of those reasons kind of stop progressive ideas. And I'm trying to break through that and say, let's make our investments closer to where people live. And but that requires change of thinking. And as far as the state hospital concerned, you know, we can still have a small state hospital there, but let's focus it, you know, let's focus it on forensic care. People who are in prison, let's focus it on forensic evaluations. Let's focus it on involuntary commitments. There are things that still can be done there that maybe some communities aren't comfortable with. So let's focus the mission there, address those issues. And it's interesting, you know, there's a building there. Some people are saying it's old and dilapidated. No, we're taking down the old and dilapidated buildings. At the beginning of this program, you said I came in 1987. It's actually not true. I came in 1986. We had a special session of the legislature. Well, the building was brand new. La Hague building was brand new then, 1986. But why aren't we using that building? And so it's kind of dealing with change, and that's the challenge before us. Will our citizens demand that their legislators change, or will the citizens let our legislators just do business like they've always done business in the past?
Do you perceive,
up to the citizens.
Do you perceive that this bill has momentum, Senator?
You know, it's interesting. I get a lot of feedback from people saying, this is the right thing, Tim. This is the right thing, Senator Mathern. But I don't know if we can change that fast. But it's interesting that, I don't know if you're aware, but the co-sponsor is Representative Matt Ruby, who is a Republican House member and the chairman of the Human Service Committee from Minot. So it's a bipartisan bill. It's got one Democrat, one Republican as sponsors to the bill. So that homework has been done. Now, whether the system can change fast enough, I guess that's why we have a four-month legislative session. I have, you know, there's going to be some amendments to the bill. There's going to be some changes. It's going to go back and forth. And I think the governor himself is kind of wondering what to do. And you might want to talk with the governor's wife someday. She's got some real strong opinions on this, as do other people. There's going to be some testimony about it today. There is, if you look on the website, or any citizen can, I introduce some testimony. They can read it about my point of view on the state hospital. There's some testimony that's going to go in from a University of Social Work student explaining these different models of care. So people can access ndlegis.gov to find the information on what is said, and that's all contained within House Bill 1012. And that's how they find the information. House Bill 1012, State Hospital, hearing today in Bismarck.
Senator, you're coming up on your 40th, I guess, anniversary of serving, a year quicker than I had said earlier. What's changed most in your eyes in the North Dakota legislature?
Well, we have access to to information, computers, networks, websites. That's dramatically changed. So that's really a big one. And another thing that's changed in terms of the makeup of the legislature, when I first got here, now I'm the longest serving senator, we had an escalating kind of progressive thought started like in 1986. And that was kind of going up for a number of years. But now we have a much more conservative orientation in the legislature. So I've seen that change. The other change I've seen is we have money now that we've never had before. And that's really why I'm promoting some of these initiatives. Now we have resources. Let's not waste them. Let's be creative. So when the day comes when we don't have as many resources, and it will come, then we have infrastructure in place that will still keep a quality of life going for North Dakotans.
My guest has been... go ahead, Senator.
You know, I've noticed kind of the drill, baby drill concept of President Trump and Secretary of Interior Burgum. Just so everybody realizes, the downside of that is when we open up all of this area for oil, that drives up the amount of oil, which drives the cost of oil down, which drives the income of the state of North Dakota down. We have a great reliance of taxes on oil that feeds our budget. Well, if that goes away because the price of oil goes down, we better be ready for lower income to the state. So let's get infrastructure in place now that makes sense for the future.
My guest has been Senator Tim Mathern. He hails from Fargo. He's working now in this session of the North Dakota Legislature, and he has served in the legislature since 1986. Senator, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us here on Main Street today.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
This is Bird Note. At this time of year, birds love fat. With a brilliant flash of its copper-red underwings, a flicker sails into the yard. Just behind it wings a stubby-tailed red-breasted nuthatch. Now, a couple of energetic black-capped chickadees dart in. And a downy woodpecker brings up the rear. What a burst of vitality on a chilly morning. What's the attraction? A cake of suet, suspended from a branch in a small wire feeder. Suet is beef fat, a high-energy food critical for birds' survival in the colder months. With few insects available in winter, suet is an especially strong magnet for birds that eat a lot of bugs in the warmer months. It's also great for birds with bills that are not adapted to opening seeds. Bird feeding suppliers now offer a wide array of processed suet cakes, some studded with berries or seeds. Perhaps a bird's equivalent of a home-baked chocolate chip cookie. Come to our website, birdnote.org, for more on suet feeders. And hurry, because here come the jays. They love suet, too. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Coming up on Main Street in the second half of our show today, Sean Abbas. He's with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and the Fargo VA Healthcare System. He stops by the Main Street studio to give us an update on all things with the VA clinic. Plus, we'll visit The Tell, a live monthly storytelling event in downtown Fargo. We've got the winning story from the November 2024 event. That's all ahead on Main Street right after this. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The Tell is a live monthly storytelling event in downtown Fargo featuring audience volunteers whose names are drawn from a hat. The chosen tellers are limited to 6 minutes and must not use any props or notes. It takes a lot of guts to share part of yourself in front of an audience, But that's what these talented storytellers do. A panel of judges then picks the winner and runners-up for the night. The teller who came in first place during the November 2024 event was Nancy Caravu, who, before a crowd at Cellar 624, recounted a multi-generational story that fit into the night's theme, Your Mother Should Know.
So tonight I'm going to tell you a story about the matriarch of my family, who's my namesake. Her name is Nancy as well, my grandma. And it's funny that I was named after her because actually I'm like, in my family alone, I am the third daughter and I was like the fifth granddaughter. So how I got so lucky, I don't know, but I'll take it. So Grandma Nancy was the matriarch of our family. She was the lady that in the 60s and 70s was like a business lady. This woman was the regional manager of 7-Eleven stores. Absolutely. And so Grandma was out there walking into these stores, and she would tell me about these stories of when she'd have to go in there and tell these employees that she was supervising, which were predominantly males, what to do. And so Grandma was out there doing her thing. What didn't get lost on me in all of this time, well, Grandma was out there taking on the world, being this worker in the world. My mom, who was the oldest child, or oldest daughter, I should say, of seven, the second oldest overall, my mom was the one that was home taking care of her siblings. So her oldest brother had already left the house. They had just moved to North Dakota from New Mexico. My grandpa was out as an athletic director, so he was out traveling with sports teams, never home really. Grandma was out traveling around to the different 7-Eleven stores, and my mom was home taking care of her younger siblings. And I couldn't help, when I was growing up, and my mom would tell me about these stories, right? My mom grew up, she took care of these siblings, she had a baby at 18, shortly after she graduated from high school. She was pregnant in high school, but we won't talk about that. But it was one of those things that I figured out. I was like, wait a minute, my sister, her age, And so she had this baby. She then had five children, my mom did, and then proceeded to do daycare for 30 years of her life, right? So she had this gaggle of children in her house at all times. And so my mom was this caretaker all the time from the time she was younger. And so when I was growing up as a teenager, I was the second youngest. And I couldn't help but like feel resentful for my mom towards my grandma Nancy, who I loved so much. But like, what could have happened in her life? What more could she have done, right? She had been given the opportunity to do more than just be this caretaker. It shaped the rest of her life. And so I would feel this resentfulness, but my mom would always be like, oh, it was what I was made to do. I love being a mom. And I'd be like, yeah, mom, okay. But we know you wanted more because we all want more, right? And so I was off going to college. I was starting new careers. I was changing my careers. And I just was like, I just felt so bad for my mom. And then fast forward to last fall, right around this time, actually, Grandma Nancy, that bold little matriarch, 88 years old, she goes to the hospital. She gets a UTI, which lands her in being really, really sick. And we spend the next 4 weeks in the hospital with Grandma, in and out. And this was honestly like the most extraordinary thing I've ever got to witness in my life, was watching the passing of my grandma. And I got to have a front row seat to watching this happen, which sounds kind of morbid in a way, but it was beautiful, like just beautiful. And so I would go and walk in there, and there's Grandma Nancy, because she would have these lucid moments, and she's like calculating on her thing. And she's like, okay, all of her sons are sitting around her, and my dad, who's the son-in-law, okay, so you're going to go over there, and you're going to grab that, and you're going to go do this, and you're going to do that, and then we're going to get the hell out of here. And so she was like lucid, and like she was back in that 7-Eleven store, right? She was doing her thing. And then she would go back into moments of like being really in a lot of pain, not being awake. And it was just this like roller coaster we went through. And then one night I was there really late with my mom, and she had been on a break. And so the rest of us females were all kind of circled around Grandma's bed. And Grandma was in a lot of pain. Grandma was like this little tiny strong lady that was just this little shell at that point. I've never seen someone in pain like that, and there wasn't much we could do about it. And my mom had been on a break. And then my mom comes back, and she walks right up to my grandma's bed, the top of her bed, and she just puts my grandma's face in her hands, and she's like, Mom, I'm here. It's Leslie. I got you. And at that moment, my grandma just went still. she was, what I realized at that moment, I was like, my mom was the only person in the world that could have calmed her at that point. My mom went back into this like core of who she was as a caretaker and took care of my grandma. And my grandma just was like at peace. And it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Like, I sat there and just watched my mom be in this space with her mom and just like melt into this world. And I just think about that all the time now, that like, it is not for the faint of heart to be a caretaker. And it takes an extraordinary human being to be a caretaker. And I think it's really important for my mom to know that she is one of those extraordinary humans that caretakes.
And a fiddle and a pig on your final day. They said that you waited till I came. We sang your favorite hymns and we held your hand. You took your final breath and that was that. But I'd never seen a person die before. I tried so hard not to cry, you know. Cause maybe sometimes we gotta trust ourselves. That when you die, you go someplace else.
A bit of Scared at Night by Kathleen Edwards. Before that, the winning story from the November 2024, The Tell at Cellar 624 in downtown Fargo. Nancy Caraview sharing the impact of two key women in her life for the theme, Your Mother Should Know. Thanks to Dave and Tracy Huebner for recording. The Tell, Fargo's live storytelling event, returns Thursday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at 4x4, upstairs at Side Street Bruin Pub. More details are on The Tell's Facebook and Instagram social media pages.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, and hydro.
Main Street continues on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Sean Abbas is from the Fargo Healthcare System of the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, and he joins us again on Main Street for an update. Sean, welcome.
Hey, Craig. Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate that.
I'm glad that you've been able to visit with us in the past. Looking forward to this conversation too, Sean. You've got some news. Some new community-based clinics, one in Williston, one in Dickinson, have now opened. Can you tell us more about those clinics?
Yeah, thanks, Craig. So we have two new clinics opening in both Williston and Dickinson, and it's just based off the new contract that we have signed with Valor. And so they're going to be taking over, they are taking over the new contracts that we have with them, and they'll be helping us provide the services to our veterans. And so they did open this week, so the 29th and the 30th. Of this month. So just this week they opened, and you know, we're still trying to get through everything in the move and get everything up and running very smoothly, but we're well on our way.
What services, Sean, can you tell me will be available at these clinics, and how might it improve healthcare access for veterans?
Too much of a change as far as services that are provided and available at the clinics. I would just say that the primary care appointments that the veterans usually had were sometimes virtual. And so now Monday through Friday during their business hours, they'll have face-to-face appointments available to some of the veteran or all the veterans that go to those two clinics. Just a little bit in detail about those clinics. They're primary care clinics. So we just have your primary care services. We have a lab there as well as doing some different lab testing that's available there. Some social work and obviously telemedicine capabilities that we have would be like audiology or nutrition services and oncology services we also offer through the telehealth network. And then we also have a behavioral health interdisciplinary program there, which I'm not sure if most veterans would know about it, but basically it's like a collaborative approach to mental health or healthcare for the veterans. So it's basically social workers and providers and the veterans themselves working together, focused on recovery and, you know, just you know, focusing on that collaborative effort to make sure that they get the services that they need there.
Sean, we've talked about this before, but I think it's worth talking about again. There are veterans who are listening who maybe have never utilized services from the VA, or maybe not in North Dakota. What would your message be to those veterans, and how can they begin taking advantage of these services?
Yeah, so any veteran that's kind of on the edge about the VA, I would say that we're not the your normal big hospital. We're more of the localized hospital, and I would say the Minnesota NICE or the North Dakota NICE is what we like to refer to it as, and it's a collaborative effort on based off of all the employees working together to ensure that veterans have a great experience once they come and see us. So I would definitely encourage them to enroll in VA healthcare via the PACT Act that was published or signed into law a couple of years ago. Thousands of more veterans are eligible to enroll in VA healthcare. So we're just encouraging them to, for one, enroll in the healthcare. And then two, you know, with the help of you and your platform, to promote some of the services that we have available to them. So I would encourage them to go on our website and check out all that information and kind of see what's available to them.
Can you give us that website address, Sean?
Yeah, if you just did, probably the easiest way is just to Google Fargo VA, and it's the only one there, and they should be able to navigate around on that.
And this would be for listeners in all of North Dakota as a place to start.
Yeah, that's correct. Yep. Mm-hmm. Went through some updating the past couple of months where we've been updating some of the programs and services that we have available at all the sites. So you can go to the Williston and Dickinson pages and kind of take a look at some of the services that we have available there.
And if someone is really not technologically savvy, they can probably just come to the clinics too to begin their journey. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're planning to have an open house or a ribbon cutting in the next few months here once we get everything fine-tuned, and we'll invite all the veterans to come in and kind of see what's available at the clinic there. Also a good resource to use that I recommend using is your county veteran service officer. I am personally tied in with all of them throughout North Dakota, and I send them all kinds of updates on different things that change throughout our healthcare system, and you know, different updates that veterans might not normally be aware of. So definitely stay tied in with the veteran service officers because they're directly linked into us here at the hospital.
Sean, we also thought it would be good to talk about the Virtual Health Resource Center. What is it, and what services does it offer, Sean?
Yeah, so the Virtual Health Resource Center, we just opened a few months ago, and basically it's like, I mean, in a nutshell, it's a help center that we have here in the hospital at the Fargo VA in Fargo that helps veterans with any of their technological needs. So we have different apps that we have available for veterans to use, and one of the main ones is the My Healthy Vet app. And they are kind of going through some sign-in changes, so they're going to have to use the login.gov instead of a different one. And that's, you know, they have till March to change all that over. And so we have a full-time staff in the office here in Fargo that are willing to help out the veterans with their technological questions or concerns and kind of help them get changed over to that new sign-on for them, and it's been extremely successful for us. That that room is full of veterans all day, every day, getting help over there, so it's a resource that was greatly needed. And I will say, in addition to that, it's not only available in Fargo. They do, I guess, maybe quarterly go out to all the clinics that we have, so we have 10 clinics throughout North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota, and they kind of make the rounds there and help veterans out there. And if they want to find out where and when to do that, that's usually on our social media or our website.
Sean, you're planning a heart health fair in February, February 25th to be exact. Tell me a little more about that.
Yeah, so it's a heart health fair that we have every year, and it's just in celebration of Heart Health Month. And so veterans can come here to the Fargo VA, the third floor auditorium, and participate in different activities that we have, maybe get a few freebies that they may have available. And then also there's a drawing, I believe, for a Fitbit. And they can just, they have CPR, they have obviously whole health, so they have the different ways to, you know, exercise and manage your healthcare from a personal perspective. So lots of resources and things available to veterans up there on the 25th.
Sean Amis, he is the Public Affairs Officer for the Fargo Healthcare System for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Sean, it's always great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Craig. Appreciate it.
The 2025 Cinema 100 film series continues on Thursday, January 16th, with the return of the classic North Dakota film Northern Lights in a new digital restoration. Northern Lights is followed by 8 more films in the series, including Anora on February 6th, and then films from India, New Zealand, and Ireland. Each film is shown twice on Thursdays at 3 and 6 p.m. at the Grand 22 Theater in Bismarck. More information on the series is available at the Cinema 100 Facebook page.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Owls have long been creatures of mystery and folklore, their calls echoing through the night and sparking curiosity and sometimes superstition. While most North Dakotans are familiar with the deep hoots of the great horned owl, our state is also home to a variety of other fascinating owl species, including the elusive barred owl. Recently, one such barred owl made headlines by swooping down a Virginia home's chimney and perching atop a Christmas tree. This unexpected visit serves as a reminder that owls, with their nocturnal habits and haunting calls, have captured human imagination for centuries. Today on Natural North Dakota, we'll explore the barred owl's presence in our state, its role in folklore, and the many other owls that call North Dakota home.
Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
Santa Claus is not the only thing that comes down a chimney. Some of you may have heard about the barred owl that recently came down the chimney of a home in Virginia and proceeded to perch atop a Christmas tree. Barred owls are a little smaller than great horned owls and lack ear tufts. Robert Stewart, in his Breeding Birds of North Dakota, noted that barred owls were likely breeding in the state, particularly along the Cheyenne River in Richland and Ransom counties. More recently, they've been documented in Pembina County. Other owls listed by Stewart include the burrowing owl, great horned owl, short-eared owl, long-eared owl, saw-whet owl, and screech owl. Although it's unclear if there's any significance to the owl's visit to the Virginia home, owls are interesting characters in folklore and mythology. They're often associated with death or the underworld. To hear an owl hoot at night, for example, portended death. Owls were also viewed as an evil omen. These beliefs may, in part, stem from their nocturnal activity and rather eerie calls. Hearing a call of an owl at night may fill a person with angst. What was that? I suspect that most North Dakotans are familiar with the low-toned hooting of the great horned owl. The call of the barred owl and screech owl are also eerie. Imagine hearing but not knowing the source of these calls. It would make one's hair stand on end. But owls are also viewed as having great wisdom and knowledge in several cultures. More recently, for example, the owl is a wise character in Winnie the Pooh, and the owl in Bambi is helpful and knowledgeable. And, of course, owls are prominent characters in the Harry Potter books and movies, where they're known for delivering the mail. I've put a link to the news item on the barred owl flying down a chimney and links to other sources of information on barred owls and owl mythology along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this poetry from Studio 47, today's poet is Todd Boss, an award-winning writer known for his musical rhythmic style. He founded Motion Poems, bringing poetry to film. Today's poem, The Mind Will Wander, explores the drifting nature of thought.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Todd Boss. He was born on December 6, 1968, in Marshfield, Wisconsin. He grew up on a cattle farm and then attended St. Olaf College, where he received his BA. From there, he went to the University of Alaska, Anchorage, where he earned his MFA in creative writing. His books include Yellow Rocket, Pitch, and Tough Luck. Boss has won the Emily Clark Belch Prize, the Midwest Booksellers' Choice Award, and he has received grants and fellowships from the Minnesota State Arts Board, as well as the McKnight Foundation. Not only has he taught at the Loft Literary Center in Minneapolis, but he is also the founder of Motion Poems, which is a film company that has created over 100 adaptations of poems. Boss has worked hard to bring poetry into the daily lives of those around him. Today's poem is The Mind Will Wander. I've long admired the work that Todd Boss creates. His work is always carefully crafted, and each line, each word, resonates with musicality. While this is generally true of most poems, Boss's work has crisp internal rhymes, and it's clear that he pays very close attention to sound. You'll hear exactly what I mean in a minute. Our poem for today is about the looping route that our imaginations can take when we're supposed to be thinking of something else. I like how this poem mimics wandering thought, how we move through the syrup of daydreaming before returning to where we started. This is The Mind Will Wander by Todd Boss. The mind will wander, as water will seep, as mice will yonder, creep the clover deep, and still knows home, as a wren will dither daily in the dome, and remember the nest's address, as honeybees comb September for nectar. So the mind will wander between the lines of music or news or conversation, will spend attention on wonder's fine wines, will even tend towards understanding, and, swollen with booty or duty or beauty, survive to wend away back to the studious hive and the subject at hand.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. All poems used with permission, recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
This is Dakota Daybook for February 3rd. North Dakota is no stranger to severe weather, and winter often provides plenty of opportunities. In early February of 1922, one of the heaviest snowfalls of the season moved south from Winnipeg, affecting North Dakota and other states. Across the state, students were sent home early due to the snowy and windy conditions. In Mandan, the superintendent arranged for local taxicabs to assist in getting children home. Some mail routes were canceled during the storm. Water pipes froze around New England in Henninger County. And in Ellendale, the city snowplow and many extra men were at work clearing the streets. The railroads did their best to continue operating. In Jamestown, where several inches of snow had already fallen, the Northern Pacific Railroad prepared to deploy its Big Russell snowplow. Although this wasn't the first snow of the season, the snow fences along the railroad tracks had kept them clear, at least until now. More than one company sent out plows to clear tracks across the state. As the storm intensified, the Northern Pacific passenger and freight trains traveling west on the Turtle Lake line were stalled near Goodrich. The engines had to be killed because there was no way to keep them supplied with water. Train crews walked through the storm to Goodrich to notify headquarters. The passengers had to spend the night in the coaches. The North Sioux train got stuck in snowdrifts near Russo in McLean County. However, passengers had a rather pleasant experience. They were taken to town while the tracks were cleared and food was provided for them. Meals were served on board, and some women passengers made sure hot coffee was available for everyone. They didn't reach Bismarck until 2 days after the storm began. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We would like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tomorrow on the show, President Trump's healthcare policies are discussed by a panel in Conversations on Healthcare. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you can join us again.